For many in the region, the future is plastics, turning natural gas byproducts into the building blocks of plastic. Industry groups and even state agencies are excited about the economic opportunity. Some say too excited.
The Ohio EPA's job is not to create jobs. It's to protect public health and the environment from these toxic industries.
I'm Carol Holsapple. This week on the Allegheny Front, the push for petrochemicals in the Ohio Valley. And it's paramount that we reduce carbon emissions to deal with climate change. But what's the best way to make it happen?
Policies come in two flavors, carrots and sticks. Most people like carrots more than sticks.
Plus, Haiti is a paradise of biodiversity, including rare frogs.
Look at the orange. That is gorgeous.
But the country is quickly losing most of its forest, and with it, many species. Those and more environmental stories are coming up on the Allegheny Front. Stay with us. Pennsylvania is one of the biggest carbon emitters in the country. In 2014, it ranked third behind Texas and California. Governor Tom Wolf on Tuesday set goals to reduce Pennsylvania's greenhouse gas emissions. State Impact Pennsylvania's Amy Sisk has more from his announcement in Pittsburgh.
Wolf's goals stem from Pennsylvania's draft climate action plan released last year. The plan says that if other states and countries take similar action, that would help prevent catastrophic consequences of climate change. Wolf wants to cut greenhouse gas emissions 26% by 2025 and 80% by 2050. Those targets are based off the amount of greenhouse gases the state emitted in 2005.
I think the capital markets are already moving in the direction of solar and wind. We need to do more to make sure that what we're doing is getting us there as quickly as possible.
Wolf says he has not yet decided if the state should also take action to support the nuclear industry. Nuclear power generation does not release carbon emissions, but it's struggling to compete against cheap natural gas and renewable energy. Amy Sisk, State Impact Pennsylvania.
While many states are trying to do their part to reduce emissions, a new report out from the Rhodium Group shows the national picture is not so encouraging. The Independent Research and Analysis Group says that in 2018, carbon emissions in the U.S. rose over 3%. That's after a few years of decline and in spite of the fact that a record number of coal-fired power plants were closed last year. The report points to economic growth as the reason for the increase, and in part, a reliance on natural gas instead of renewable energy to replace coal as a power source. This rise in emissions means that the U.S. is further away from meeting its commitments to the Paris Climate Agreement. About 3 years ago, most of the world's nations signed on to the Paris Agreement. And while President Trump has vowed to take the U.S. out of the deal, the vast majority of countries are still in it. They met recently in Poland at the United Nations Annual Climate Conference. NPR's Rebecca Hersher was there, and the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier spoke with her for our podcast, Trump on Earth.
President Trump, after he took office, vowed to take the U.S. out of the Paris Climate Agreement, and he's made it clear that he's been very skeptical of climate science.
Yeah, I don't believe it. No, I don't believe it. And here's the other thing. Right now, we're at the cleanest we've ever been, and it's very important to me. But if we're clean, but every other place on Earth is dirty, that's not so good.
So what did the U.S. delegation do or say at the conference this year?
Well, the U.S. did basically two things, two contradictory things. On one hand, representatives led by somebody, an official from the White House, did a side event, which got a lot of press, where they talked about the future of fossil fuels, namely coal and nuclear. Most of it was about coal. The event was basically about how making coal technology release fewer greenhouse gases is an important part of the overall energy mix, global energy mix. And that if you ask the people on the panel, coal is going to be burned all over the world for many years to come, like it or not. And so making it release fewer greenhouse gases, either by capturing those greenhouse gases at the source when it's burned or sequestering them after they're burned, that's going to be a big part of reducing overall greenhouse gas emissions globally. That was not a particularly welcome message at this conference.
We strongly believe that no country should have to sacrifice economic prosperity or energy security in pursuit of environmental sustainability.
You know, this is a conference theoretically about big, bold, global, multilateral agreements to totally transition the world economy away from fossil fuels. So needless to say, a side event hosted by the Trump administration that talks about how great coal is was not that popular.
Is this the one where there were hecklers in the audience?
Exactly. So like half the audience, or maybe even more, was made up of a protest group who got up and yelled at the panelists and eventually marched out after disrupting the proceedings. But the other thing the Trump administration was doing was negotiating the rule book, the same as every other country, because even though President Trump has said that the U.S. intends to withdraw from the 2015 Paris Agreement, there's a waiting period. And it's designed to protect against exactly this scenario. So you sign a big agreement and then there's an election and the new person doesn't agree with it. Well, there's this cooling off period where the new person can't immediately pull out. So the U.S. is still in the Paris Agreement. And as a result, we had State Department negotiators working on those rules for how people or how different countries will count their emissions and how different countries will communicate with each other about those emissions. And by all accounts, those negotiators who are career people have been doing this for decades were acting in pretty much the same way the U.S. has in past years. You know, they're known for being pretty tough negotiators, for really pushing for transparency, for example, and that was no different this year.
So it was sort of business as usual on the one hand, but kind of the Trump agenda on the other hand.
Exactly, yeah.
So I noticed one other thing that the U.S. did was it joined Kuwait, Russia, and Saudi Arabia to block the adoption of a U.N. climate change report. If the U.S. is not going to be, you know, one of the leaders to push for, you know, bigger reductions in greenhouse gases, who is going to be driving the agenda at these meetings?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. At this meeting, it appeared that the EU, the European Union, was stepping up in some ways, as was China. China has been a really important ally of the U.S., was a very important ally of the U.S. in passing the Paris Agreement in the first place and creating a coalition around that. And China was once again sort of pushing the negotiations this time. That, you know, they're a big deal. Their economy is very, very large. And the EU also, the EU has seen emissions reductions. They're actually the only entity that signed on to the Paris Agreement that has seen emissions reductions. So in that way, they have some moral authority. And at this COP, they were banding together with small island nations and vulnerable nations. These are low-lying or poorer countries that have been feeling the effects of climate change from sea level rise or from stronger storms or from drought and famine. They had created a coalition called the High Ambition Coalition, who were pushing other countries to promise bigger things in the future. So I think the U.S. standing with those other three countries, all major oil producers, you're right. It signaled that the U.S. was on the outskirts, and it created space for these other countries to move in and become, you know, leaders.
In the absence of a federal leadership on climate change, what did you learn about what cities and states are and can be doing about climate?
What I learned is that local governments all over the U.S. are already doing things that have to do with climate change, whether it's adapting to new weather patterns in their areas or dealing with stronger storms or transitioning their own grids to cleaner sources. This has been going on for a long time. And so after the Trump administration signaled that it might not be interested in being part of this international agreement anymore, all of these cities and states and businesses basically created a coalition that's meant to signal to the rest of the world, hey, we're still doing stuff. Whether or not that's part of the Paris Agreement, we, smaller entities, are doing things that are going to reduce U.S. emissions. Now, how big that emissions reduction will be from non-federal government policy remains to be seen. And there are certainly things that the Trump administration could do that would offset those emissions reductions from local sources. So, you know, rolling back regulations on coal-fired power plants or on wellhead methane emissions at the federal level, that's going to release more emissions. So even if cities are reducing their emissions at the local or state level, you may see an increase in U.S. emissions. But the message that these local leaders are trying to send is at least you can work with the U.S. in good faith. Civil society does not think that climate change is a hoax, and we're taking action.
Rebecca Hersher covers climate and the environment for NPR. She spoke with the Allegheny Front's Reed Frazier for our Trump on Earth podcast. You can hear more of that conversation at TrumpOnEarth.org or wherever you get your podcasts. One way to lessen the effects of climate change is to stop carbon emissions from getting into the atmosphere in the first place. Scientists are searching for ways to capture the gas and store it. But that emerging technology has been slow to get off the ground. State Impact Pennsylvania's Amy Sisk looks at what Pennsylvania is doing to develop it and what obstacles stand in its way. She starts at Penn State University.
I am walking through campus looking for the building where I'm about to meet with a couple of researchers, and I think I'm here.
Hi there, so nice to meet you.
We all crowd around a table in one of the school's engineering departments.
My name is Tieyuan Zhu. I'm an assistant professor of geophysics.
I'm Eugene Morgan. I'm an assistant professor of petroleum and natural gas engineering.
I'm Sanjay Srinivasan. I'm a professor in the Department of Energy and Mineral Engineering.
We're here to talk about carbon capture and sequestration. When you hear people say clean coal, that's what they're talking about. It might just be the key to preventing a climate disaster if scientists and companies can figure out whether it works and how to do it cheaply. The people in this room are trying. They're studying carbon dioxide, the greenhouse gas emitted by coal and natural gas-fired power plants, and by industry. The idea is to filter out the CO2 from the rest of the emissions, then shoot it through a pipeline to an injection site where it's pumped into the ground. Here's Srinivasan.
It's not like there is a swimming pool where these things are stored. These gases and supercritical fluids have to migrate through very small pore spaces.
The hope is they'll stay trapped in the rock forever. Question is, what if one day the carbon dioxide moves somewhere unwanted?
It's really important to keep track of where the CO2 is in this.
Morgan says in places where this is being tested, carbon dioxide is often injected down old wells into oil fields.
Those wells offer a very nice pathway for CO2 to travel up.
Potentially into an aquifer or back up into the air. Here's Srinivasan again.
Eventually, if you want to keep the greenhouse gas away from the environment, and if it seeps back into the environment, that's always a problem.
They're trying to develop a way to track CO2 with data from injection sites in Texas and Mississippi. When pushed underground at a high pressure, carbon dioxide forms small cracks in the rock.
I have a sound. Probably I can show you now.
So queues up a PowerPoint presentation and hits play. He's turned seismic data into sound to help explain it. Those pops indicate the energy from the carbon dioxide traveling about the fractures. The smaller the fracture, the slower the pops. The goal is to create a way to follow the spread of carbon dioxide in real time. Between Penn State, other universities, and a Department of Energy lab near Pittsburgh, a lot of research on carbon capture and sequestration is taking place in Pennsylvania. But on-the-ground projects testing this technology are located elsewhere. Some people, like John Quigley, say they could be here.
We found that Pennsylvania had several hundred years' worth of storage potential.
A decade ago, Quigley was Secretary of the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources when the agency released several reports on the potential for the technology in Pennsylvania. Quigley at the time served in the Rendell administration, and he wanted to pursue what he calls a carbon network, capturing carbon dioxide from the state's coal plants and piping it to a site for storage. He knows that's a heavy lift, and he says governors since have not pursued it.
It starts with a demonstration of leadership and intent at the state level, that this is a priority, and then gathering these stakeholders and starting the really complicated conversations about how we're going to move this thing off square one.
The topic has not totally fallen off the state's radar. The state is in a regional partnership testing storage underground, and Governor Tom Wolf urged Congress to increase a tax credit for storage projects. Jared Daniels with the U.S. Department of Energy says it could make a difference.
There are a lot of people out in private sectors and private companies in the United States that are talking about it.
Because capturing carbon emissions hits a big obstacle, cost. Take, for example, the $1 billion project completed at a coal plant in Texas, the first major carbon capture system in the United States.
If you go out and talk to some of the folks that have started those first-of-a-kind units, they know that if they built a second-of-a-kind, it would come in probably 20 or 30% cheaper just because of the lessons that they learned building and operating that first unit for a year or two.
Given the price tag, federal and state subsidies have helped the industry pioneer the technology. Some experts like Ed Rubin at Carnegie Mellon University say tougher regulations are needed to make it more widespread.
Policies come in two flavors, carrots and sticks. Turns out most people like carrots more than sticks.
That tax credit Congress passed last year, he considers that a carrot.
I think carrots are wonderful. We need carrots.
But he says we need sticks, too. Major policies like the Obama-era plan requiring states to dramatically cut emissions, or a cap-and-trade system, or a carbon tax.
If the motivating issue is climate change, we need deep reductions in emissions, not shallow reductions, and we need them fairly quickly.
Back at the Penn State campus, the researchers also feel the clock ticking as they work to better track the movement of carbon dioxide underground. Here's Morgan.
That sort of tool needs to be developed, proved, and field ready.
So that even bigger carbon storage operations can start up. Srinivasan says that's an important part of the strategy to combat climate change because the transition to renewable energy is slow. Flip on a light switch, and more often than not, that electricity still comes from fossil fuels.
In my opinion, I think these gentlemen will agree that carbon sequestration, especially geologic sequestration, is almost a must. We have to do it.
They're just trying to make it happen sooner rather than later. Amy Sisk, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Pennsylvania's energy mix is changing, like Governor Wolf's new focus on renewable energy to cut greenhouse gas emissions and stave off the worst impacts of climate change. But will we ever get to zero carbon emissions? Well, you can hear from a panel of experts on this topic at a free public forum hosted by WESA-FM, State Impact Pennsylvania, and the Allegheny Front. The date is Tuesday, January 29th, and it starts at 6:15 p.m. at the Energy Innovation Center in Pittsburgh's Hill District neighborhood. Check out AlleghenyFront.org for more and to register. You've likely heard that Shell Chemical is building a massive facility called an ethane cracker north of Pittsburgh in Beaver County along the Ohio River. Well, now another company is moving closer to building a second cracker downriver in Belmont County, Ohio. And some people are predicting this is the beginning of a petrochemical hub in the region. The Allegheny Front's Julie Grant has been covering this. Hey, Julie.
Hey, Kara.
So this is really in our backyard, about a little over an hour drive southwest of Pittsburgh. Can you catch us up on what's happening with the ethane cracker in Ohio?
Sure. So the company, PTT Global Chemical, based in Thailand, and its partner, have proposed a $10 billion ethane cracker near the town of Shadyside, Ohio. The plant would use ethane from natural gas wells to make 1.5 million tons of plastic per year. It's similar to the Shell plant that you mentioned. It would use the ethane produced at gas wells in the region to make ethylene and polyethylene. These are pellets that can be manufactured into many plastic products that we use every day, plastic bags, medical devices, car parts, all kinds of things.
The Shell plant is currently under construction. Where is the PTT plant in its process?
Well, over the holidays, environmental regulators in Ohio approved both the air and water discharge permits for it, paving the way for the project to get started.
So people are very excited about this, right?
Yeah, some people are. And many people who are spoke at a public hearing late last year about the company's air permit. They've promised more than 5,000 construction jobs to build the plant and at least 500 permanent jobs. So groups like Building and Trade Group spoke in favor of the plant. A lot of political leaders showed up. They've been dealing with high poverty rates, especially because they've lost a lot of coal and steel industry jobs. And they've been seeing a boost in the rise in natural gas in Ohio, new wells and pipelines. Belmont County Commissioner Mark Thomas was one who gave testimony that night. And then I spoke with him more recently by Skype after the air permit was issued.
We've been working on getting to this point, this permit issue, for 3 years now.
Why has the county invested so much time in this?
Well, Thomas says this is the largest economic development opportunity in the history of the state. And even more important to him is the impact he thinks it's going to have on the Belmont County area.
It's going to provide hundreds, if not thousands, of job opportunities for our youth and for, quite frankly, children that are not even born at this point.
Well, so there's a real expectation that this is going to be a long-term economic game changer for the region.
Yeah, even the environmental regulators sounded excited about it. In the press release announcing the air permit, Ohio EPA Director Craig Butler said the agency is, quote, proud to be part of the effort to bring critical jobs to Ohio. Again, this was in its announcement of issuing the final environmental air permit for PTT to build the ethane cracker.
Well, like Shell's ethane plant in Beaver County, this proposed project has been criticized by environmentalists and some residents of the area. What do critics have to say about it?
Okay, well, let's hear from Jill Hunkler. She lives about 20 miles from where the Ohio plant would be built.
Unacceptable in my mind. It's not about jobs. The Ohio EPA's job is not to create jobs. It's to protect public health and the environment from these toxic industries. Do your job.
The Ohio EPA says the facility will not have an adverse impact on the air, water, or health of the surrounding communities. That's a quote. And the volatile organic compounds and particulate matter and other pollutants it's expected to produce are lower than those expected from the Shell ethane cracker. Hunkler and many others are still concerned, though. They're worried that the Ohio Valley could turn into the next Cancer Alley. They're referring to a heavily polluted area of chemical manufacturing facilities in Louisiana. And they say their area needs jobs that won't harm people.
And what about the climate implications for these facilities?
Well, it's known that the Shell plant is expected to emit more than 2 million tons of greenhouse gases a year, and add that to another 1.8 million tons from the Belmont facility if it's built. So while natural gas is supposed to be a bridge fuel from coal, which emits higher amounts of greenhouse gases, critics are pointing to projects like this and saying, look, this is also emitting a lot of greenhouse gases.
How would the Belmont cracker fit into the larger picture of natural gas development in this region?
Well, something that I've heard people say along the way in reporting about this is that while one ethane cracker, like the Shell plant, is just a facility, once you have two crackers in the area and there's a talk of a third in West Virginia, then you're really starting to create a new industry here. And in addition to the crackers, one company is planning to start storing natural gas liquids like ethane in salt caverns in the region this year. And while there's already some plastics manufacturing in the region, there's a push for increased plastic and chemical manufacturing in the region to use the pellets that the crackers are going to produce.
So is the Belmont cracker a done deal?
Well, now that the environmental permits have been issued, it's up to the company. It's up to PTT GCA. But they have yet to officially announce that they're moving forward with the project.
Okay, Julie. Well, I'm sure you'll keep us updated on this.
Thanks, Kara.
That was the Allegheny Front's Julie Grant. And there's more of her reporting on this at AlleghenyFront.org. I'm Kara Holsapple, and you're listening to the Allegheny Front. Caribbean island, once full of lush trees and teeming with wildlife, is nearly completely deforested and undergoing a mass extinction event. State Impact Pennsylvania's Marie Cusick has more on new research from a Temple University scientist showing Haiti is closer to losing its rich biodiversity than almost any country in the world.
Cute. Pretty frog. And look at the orange. Wow. That is gorgeous.
Blair Hedges spent decades in the rainforests of Haiti studying new and rare species, like this frog he came across during a trip in 2011.
There's another individual calling there. This is quite interesting.
Although he's had many surprises over the years, like this one, he says he was shocked by the results of his latest research. In a recent paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, he and his co-authors revealed that Haiti has lost almost all of its virgin forests.
That's something that, up until this analysis, nobody had any idea it was that bad.
And because of this deforestation, they estimate that more than half of Haiti's species will be wiped out by the year 2035.
Haiti is in the middle of a mass extinction, and it's already lost a large number of species because entire areas where unique species exist are no longer present.
Using NASA satellite imagery to analyze the landscape, Hedges and his colleagues found that the country only has about 1% of its primary forest left, as people have been cutting down trees to farm and make charcoal for cooking.
Most people working in Haiti could see that there's very little forest left, but none of us really expected it to disappear that quickly.
Sitting in his office at Temple University in Philadelphia, where he directs its Center for Biodiversity, Hedges explains that Haiti is at the forefront of a global trend, with species disappearing at up to 1,000 times the normal rate.
We're unquestionably into a mass extinction globally.
Haiti's story is largely one of habitat destruction, cutting down trees. But that's just one of the components in an ongoing worldwide mass extinction driven by climate change, invasive species, and other human-related factors.
You think of removing the forests as you're just removing the trees, the plants, but actually you're removing everything.
Stuart Pym, a professor of conservation ecology at Duke University, was not involved in this study, but calls it a tragic and brutal example of what happens when people destroy forests.
I think Haiti is probably the worst place in the world to be a species.
He says that biodiversity isn't just a nice thing to have.
The natural world, the natural environment, provides very, very valuable services to us.
Known as ecosystem services, they include things like when a forest, for example, helps to clean the air and water and prevent soil erosion. Pym says this became clear to European settlers who cut down many of the trees in the eastern U.S., including Pennsylvania, which was almost completely deforested.
And so Haiti's story ought to resonate. It is a lesson that we need to heed in terms of managing our own wild areas, our own forests, our own watersheds and rivers.
With so little original forest left in Haiti, Hedges says he's had to take on a new role, from being just a scientist to also becoming a conservationist. 42 of the country's 50 highest mountains have lost all their virgin forests. So he's leading an effort with an organization he co-founded called Haiti National Trust, planning to buy up one of the last remaining mountaintops.
We're really looking forward to saving at least this piece of Haiti's biodiversity.
The purchase would protect an area in southwest Haiti roughly 1.5 square miles in size. It's called Grand Bois, or Big Forest. Marie Cusick, State Impact, Pennsylvania.
Thanks for joining us on the Allegheny Front. For more stories about biodiversity, interviews with scientists, and even art about animals and nature, visit AlleghenyFront.org. We'll see you back here next week. And you can always find us on Twitter, at Allegheny Front. Kathy Naur is the executive producer of our show. I'm Kara Holsapple.
Support for the Allegheny Front comes from the Heinz Endowments, the Pittsburgh Foundation, and the Park Foundation. The Richard King Mellon Foundation supports our coverage of conservation. State Impact Pennsylvania is a collaboration among the Allegheny Front, WESA, WITF, and WHYY to cover the Commonwealth's energy economy.